You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. All in the Family, Michael Gandolfini on loss, confidence, and playing his father's famous character. By Britt Hinemuth. Opening photograph by Eric Carter. Few parts have reached the same heights in television's pantheon as James Gandolfini's Tony Soprano. The Sopranos was appointment TV at the dawn of cable, and 13 years after the series ended, The Many Saints of Newark, a prequel film, will land on HBO Max this fall, with Michael Gandolfini succeeding his father as a young Tony. As the buzz begins, Gandolfini, who also stars opposite Tom Holland in the Russo brothers' adaptation of Nico Walker's Cherry, out earlier this year, opens up about stepping into Tony's shoes. In the opening photograph, he wears Louis Vuitton men's clothing. Early memories of the Sopranos are few. My dad didn't want me to see Tony Soprano. The violence, the angry, the mean. Of course, I was on set and would visit him in his trailer, but I had never watched the show. I never knew Tony Soprano. I only knew my dad. Gandolfini spent summers with his dad on the Jersey Shore. Because he was beloved down there, I would get jobs I was unqualified for, like working at a body shop at 8 years old. When Gandolfini was 14, his father died of a heart attack while on vacation in Rome. A football injury sent Gandolfini to try out for a high school play. I'd gone to acting therapy after my dad passed. I'd resisted it, but it sparked something. A manager took a chance and sent him to his first ever audition for HBO's The Deuce. She called the next day. "You're one for one." He played Joey Dwyer and calls it an incredible time of failing and learning and getting my sea legs. Co-star James Franco was a formative mentor. Upon hearing about the Sopranos prequel, Gandolfini thought, "Absolutely not. What if I'm not good?" But when his manager insisted he audition, he decided it was time to see the first season. "It was really hard to watch my dad," he says. "I recorded 4 hours of his monologues with Melfi and walked around New York with them constantly, constantly, constantly playing in my ear." When he auditioned for creator David Chase, "I had this unspoken trust that David wasn't going to cast me if there was even a shred that this isn't going to work." 3 months later, he got the offer. It's an origin story through the eyes of Dicky Moltisanti, Christopher's father. The Tony Soprano we know has this beautiful vulnerability underneath and this rough exterior. But what if we flip that on its side and you watch a creative, hopeful, kind, curious kid get whittled down and formed into what he has to be? Then he watched all 6 seasons over 6 weeks. It transcends everything: Republican, Democrat, patriarchy, and matriarchy. As for the historically polarizing series finale, I'm not touching that one. Edie Falco told him to relax and have fun on set. "Enjoy yourself. Know you're lucky," he says. In Cherry, Gandolfini plays the hometown friend to Holland's bank robber with PTSD. "Not playing the Italian New York kid, having them believe in me and allow me to play such a complicated, beautiful role was such a gift." "Looking back," he says, "my dad constantly told me, if I'd ask a question about acting, I'm not your acting coach, I'm your dad," which I really appreciate now. long game. In hair care, the push for sustainability is personal and global, by Laura Regensdorf. Over the past months, to the complete surprise of every roommate I've ever had, I acquired a green thumb. It's hard to ignore the needs of houseplants when you are similarly planted at home. The succulent hanging in the kitchen window hit yardstick length at the same time my braid began tucking into my waistband. I snipped off the occasional shriveled leaf with the same attention that I gave my split ends. Meditative pruning gave me the feeling of a bonsai master, which made my hair something of a bonsai itself, steadfast and deserving of preservation like an old-growth forest in miniature. As my focus shrank to the scope of my Brooklyn apartment, sustaining life with regular waterings and conditioning hair mask, my household input-output highlighted a far-reaching concern. Delivery boxes piled up, recycling bins neared overflow. Surveying shampoo bottles lining the tub, I recalled a stark warning from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. By 2050, there could be more plastic in the oceans than fish. What is the future? What do we need to be doing? Helen Reavy, the hairstylist behind Act and Acre, says about the push for sustainability. Since its debut 2 years ago, Act and Acre has been rooted in earthly matters. Refill pouches of its hair cleanse and conditioner minimize the pale brown plastic bottles in circulation. The new castor oil mask, which landed just in time to cocoon my moisture-sapped hair, comes in an aluminum tube. Recyclable in one sense, regenerative in another, it speaks to the conservation of resources. It's about creating good habits, Reavy says, and treating yourself at the same time. The drive to deliver clean formulas and mindful packaging is visible across the industry. Sandor, a sleek newcomer from hairstylist Sabrina Zine and Taja Feisner, a model studying sustainability policy, just launched a biodegradable shampoo and conditioner in earthy aluminum vessels. The metal can be infinitely recycled, says Feisner. Basically, 75% of the aluminum that has ever been mined is still in use today. Anomaly, a new range from Priyanka Chopra Jonas, pairs recycled plastic bottles with ingredients that read like a recipe. Rosemary, quinoa, coconut oil. R and Company has rolled out Blue, a sustainable hair care capsule with color-blocked containers made from post-consumer recycled plastic as well as sugarcane bioresin, an effort to reduce the virgin plastics pipeline. The wave of shampoo bars promises an end to packaging altogether. But long-haired traditionalists can take some comfort in Rahua's math. One recycled plastic bottle equals 1 acre of Amazon rainforest preserved. It's not just about what product do you deliver, but what's your purpose, says Barbara Delaire, Aveda's global brand president. In January, the company announced model activist Arizona Muse as its first sustainability advocate, amplifying existing efforts. Vegan formulas, improved plastics, even blockchain-tracked sourcing for vanilla. Over Zoom, Muse talks up the lightweight mask in the new botanical repair line, which protects against the elements. Still, she gestures to her chin-length bob, I have actually found the hack to damaged hair, which is just to have short hair. That sounds freeing, a lighter chop to go with a lighter carbon footprint. But I can't shake the defining image from Miranda July's Kajillionaire, the waist-length hair worn by old Dolio, Evan Rachel Wood. In the film, the androgynous protagonist lives with grifter parents in a bubble factory where pink froth seeps down the wall like an unholy shampoo. However much old Dolio's hair exists outside the realm of style, not cutting it isn't simply passive, July explains by email. It also is kind of tree-like in its strength, elemental. It just grows. There's something deeply sexy about that. Like those rainforest acres, spared by well-meaning hair care, old growth deserves a new lease on life. Surveillance State, a new documentary uncovers FBI attempts to undermine the fight for civil rights by Anthony Bresnahan. In the photos, Martin Luther King Jr., as seen in MLK, FBI, director Sam Pollard, The March on Washington. Martin Luther King Jr. probably had too much faith in the decency of America. In director Sam Pollard's new documentary, MLK, FBI, close friends and family of the murdered civil rights leader say he dismissed concerns that government authorities, under the direction of J. Edgar Hoover, were tracking his every move. The truth arrived in the form of a threatening letter and embarrassing recordings from bugged hotel rooms sent to King in an effort to demoralize and silence him. A half century later, it's the FBI that's racked with shame over its conduct. In the documentary, distributed by IFC and executive produced by, among others, Vanity Fair's David Friend, former director James Comey says this represented the Bureau's darkest period. I've done lots of documentaries about the African-American experience and the civil rights movement, says Pollard, a three-time Emmy winner who shared an Oscar nomination with Spike Lee for their 1997 documentary, Four Little Girls. This was an opportunity to look at American history from a deeper, more nuanced perspective in terms of the role of the FBI in trying to discredit Dr. King and who he was, and breaking down the mythology of the FBI that I grew up with as a young African-American man in the 60s. The recordings of King, rumored to reveal his alleged affairs, are under seal by the National Archives until 2027, and the film explores whether they should be released at all. For Pollard, the possible benefits outweigh the potential cost. It'll be an opportunity to hear King maybe talking about strategies they had in places like Selma, in places like Birmingham, in places like Chicago, which can be very revealing about the mindset of the movement during that period, he says. Understanding that King was not a monogamous man, that he had a complex personal life, doesn't demystify for me or take away his importance in terms of his place in American history. Nobody's life is black and white. Human beings tend to try to think that way because it makes them feel good. I'm not here to make people feel good. I'm here to make people think. We love Lucy. I Hate Susie co-creator and Succession writer whiz Lucy Prebble talks her game by Lauren Meckling. Opening photos, Lucy Prebble created I Hate Susie with her friend Billy Piper, pictured here with Prebble, who stars in it, and Piper in the show. For a certain segment of Americans who've been lucky enough to lament changes in pandemic programming, one of the more annoying privations of 2020 and 2021 has been the absence of a new season of Succession. August came and went without a peep from the delightfully despicable Roys. It wasn't until Kieran Culkin's appearance on Mark Maron's WTF podcast in late August that we learned that the people who brought us those tasty hour-long morsels were at last getting ready to start filming season three. In the meantime, the television gods have something wonderful to tide us over. I Hate Susie, a blisteringly funny HBO Max series from Succession writer and co-executive producer Lucy Prebble. Created with and starring Prebble's close friend Billy Piper, the show chronicles the undoing of Susie Pickles, a child star turned Who Weekly-level British actor, whose life is upended after her phone is hacked and a compromising photograph ends up everywhere. The episode's deranged humor and jittery energy will feel familiar to fans of Prebble's work, including the great many who didn't realize Prebble is part of what made them love Succession. With Susie, Prebble comes out of the shadows and approaches the ranks of ingenious female television creators like Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Michaela Cole, whose names have become as recognizable as their projects. I got a message from my ex, and he said, "Well done. It's a really brilliant show. You've passed all your anxiety on to the rest of the world," Prebble says, with a sorry-not-sorry grin. She is zooming from her sister's garage in southeast England, an hour or so south of London. She looks like a glamorous hostage with Nigella Lawson barrel curls and her camera positioned up high to capture the room's cold drabness. Gray tiles, foosball table, the exciting quickness and unapologetically black humor that are the hallmarks of Prebble's writing are features of her conversation. As she fields questions, her demeanor alternates between intimidatingly composed and raucous, delivering responses in paragraphs punctuated by laughing fits. "My first port of call is quite cerebral and over-rational," Prebble says, "and slightly controlling." She loosened the reins on I Hate Susie, which is more intimate than any of her previous work. She is still best known as a playwright, and Bloomsbury has just published a collection of her four staged plays. Piper's incandescent and frankly insane performance brings to life a woman who, as Piper tells me a few days after my chat with Prebble, doesn't know who she is. She's taken many faces, guises, personalities, and applied them accordingly all her life. In other words, it's a show about an actor, but it's really a show about playing the part and losing the plot. The eight episodes might move viewers, especially women viewers, to shed tears of recognition and in the end of glorious release. I Hate Susie trains its eye, often in close-up, on a woman who is hemmed in by her cuckolded husband. Her manager, cum best friend, and the colleague whose penis happens to be the one in the viral picture. It starts as a credible and contemporary setup, a woman on the verge of losing her reputation and livelihood. So much for the aging Disney princess role that Pickles just landed. But a couple of installments in, the absurdity, surrealism, and horror pile on. Piper says that in conceiving the tone, their references were the works of mid-period Woody Allen, and to a larger degree, Louis C.K.'s auto-fictional Louis. She stops mid-sentence to acknowledge the accusations against both men. C.K. apologized for his actions, and Allen has continued to deny the allegations against him. But what we loved about Louis, says Piper, was even though the premise is real and the issues are real, it took you in directions slightly left of center and slightly heightened. Shame. Each episode is named after a stage of grief, centers on a roughly 25-minute masturbation scene. The sequence breaks the fourth wall, with friends and lovers letting themselves into Susie's psyche while she's wanking. Piper's performance here is a tour de force, an athletically raw evocation of agony, ecstasy, and abject fear. Billy's very warm and emotional, Preble says. There have been times in my life I've needed her to push me off a cliff or help me do something I'm overcautious about. Preble was 22 when her first play, The Sugar Syndrome, an internet chat room love triangle, was staged. She took a detour to write for television and worked on Secret Diary of a Call Girl, a series based on the Belle du Jour blog, which starred Piper. You may not have been blown away, and neither was Preble, but it was worse for her since it was her fault. After two seasons, she left to write her breakout play, Enron, a dramatization of the downfall of the Texas energy giant that enjoyed a brief stint on Broadway. As reading material, Enron is brilliance, with dialogue that foreshadows Preble's seat in the Succession writer's room. This is the largest single transfer of wealth I've ever seen. We're like the Roman Empire. We're going effing down, are two Texas traders, sounding proto-Roman Roy. Preble's 2019 spy drama, A Very Expensive Poison, about the death of former KGB whistleblower Alexander Litvinenko, is a global spy drama rendered as a spare and affecting love story. Spy stories are romances. White-collar criminals are jesters. Turning things inside out is Preble's special sauce. Tidy concept and slick showbiz jokes aside, I Hate Susie works because of the ugly honesty and animating spirit of subversion. Susie is a reservoir of insecurity and self-loathing, the result of years and years of accommodating a culture of judgment and rejection, of being appraised and discarded. The show's aggressive title is a nod to Lucille Ball, a natural hero of Preble's. She was one of the first woman TV producers ever. Now it feels like we live in a world where they don't want the I Love Lucy. They want the I Hate Lucy, says Preble. It tells you how we treat women in public positions. One of the show's sillier-seeming bits features a theater director in charge of a play called A Party with Monica Lewinsky, a made-up work that sounds like a bad version of a Lucy Preble project. He only speaks after the most ponderous pauses, which are almost hilarious, but look a little closer, and his quest for creative expression is condescending and cruel. I'm a quick talker, and I've worked with a lot of men who speak very slowly and seldom, Preble says. That's a strategy for building authority. They will just wait when you ask them a question, and then you say, oh, sorry, sorry, I'm being stupid. We associate those qualities with certain types of men with wisdom, whereas if a woman is silent, she's not really contributing. It was Piper who helped bring Susie home. After years of talking about every disappointment and dream, including their shared belief that they should create something together about women and friendship, they started collaborating in a more formal way, spending days in rooms batting around ideas. They waited 2 years to show their work to producers or pitch to networks, wanting to be sure they had done exactly what they envisioned before anyone dared give notes. Susie is not the sort of thing that could have been dreamed up by committee, certainly not one of men. Part of what makes Succession superior to all other ensemble dramas is the female energy that courses through it. I push hard on that, Preble says. In the show's original pilot, for instance, Jerry was written as a man. Preble helped rewrite her as a woman, a great decision. And while other members of the team excel at the exquisite masculine banter that's actually pathetic, Preble says that she gravitates toward Shiv. The interior damage and controlling nature of someone like Shiv is coming from a female sensibility. That's a character I love to write. Shiv is the Roy most like Logan, and also most like Preble. She's so competitive. She doesn't compete. She keeps her cards close to her chest. I'm going away quite soon for work, Preble tells me. That could mean anything, anywhere. They will not let me say more than we're all trying to get people more succession as quickly as possible. She cackles after her air quotes. You can use your imagination. Charming Billy. In the last year, Billie Eilish scored 5 Grammys, went multi-platinum 8 times, released the new Bond theme, and was forced to cancel a 49-date tour. Then she turned 19. By Keziah Weir, with photographs by Quill Lemons, styled by Gabriella Carifa Johnson. Opening photo, artist Billie Eilish, photographed in Los Angeles. Before I ever meet Billie Eilish, I feel like I know her. I have already watched her ride a pinto across a New Zealand beach, get her sprained ankle wrapped, grind on a bag of bagels, blow a slobbery raspberry into her brother Phineas's face, mimic her mother, expound on the seriousness of the coronavirus, shoot water out one nostril while using a neti pot, and fit much of an Oscar Schmidt Aloha ukulele headstock into her mouth. I know what a Billie Eilish burp sounds like, and also a sneeze. Here in the trailer for a forthcoming documentary about her life is blonde-haired toddler Billie Eilish Pirate Baird O'Connell perched on a piano bench. Here she is a few years later, singing at a talent show. I have listened to her perform at the Democratic National Convention, the Academy Awards, the Grammys, where her 2019 debut album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, racked up a total of 11 wins. Coachella, Saturday Night Live, Howard Stern, NPR's Tiny Desk, Ellen, The Tonight Show, and In a Car with James Corden. The muchness of Eilish's online presence is overwhelming and kaleidoscopic, her own posts and performances spawning fan accounts and compilation videos and ecstatic reaction videos and memes, so many memes, refractions of Billie Eilish ad infinitum. There is the Bader-Meinhof effect, too. Once you are aware of Eilish, she really is everywhere. She's trending on Twitter. Her emotive face shows up in a group text. Her beautiful voice dopplers out of a passing car. In the 4 short years since she signed with Interscope Records, she has risen to mind-boggling stardom. Her 49-show Where Do We Go arena tour, which had just kicked off in March and would have run through September had it not been for the pandemic, sold out days after tickets went on sale. In October, when we first speak, and this was October a year ago, her music video for the deliciously delinquent pop trap tune Bad Guy hits 1 billion views. A couple weeks later, she drops Therefore I Am, a single from her forthcoming album, and it's watched 12 million times in the first 24 hours. And she isn't yet 19 at that time. Because of all this preconditioning, to profile a celebrity is to dip a toe into the waters of extreme fandom. It is both thrilling and banal to see Eilish pop up on Zoom. She's wending her way through her family's home in Highland Park, Los Angeles, where she's filmed so many clips for Instagram and conducted almost all of her interviews over the last 4 years. I just made a magnificent breakfast, Eilish tells me, as she props her phone against a mirror in the little blue bathroom. This, too, seems normal. Eilish has few, if any, pretenses. Her hands smell like garlic and onions, she says. I have to wash them now. She makes a show of it, finishing with a little ta-da move, as though she should be wearing a top hat. I half expect her to start singing. Alas, she does not. She's in an oversized black T-shirt, emblazoned with the rapper Duckworth's face. She's embraced the body-obscuring street style, pioneered by female artists like Missy Elliott and TLC. Earlier this year, my album Igor was the #1 album in the country. Tyler, the creator, growled at the 2019 American Music Awards. And then, this 17-year-old girl who dresses like a quarterback decided to change that. He is her longtime idol in music and fashion. At 5'3", she's almost always dwarfed by whoever she's with, be it one of her burly bodyguards or her lanky 6-foot-tall brother, Phineas, who is also her producer and collaborator. but she could be any height on screen. And throughout our conversations, she's either got the phone placed somewhere around her knees, so she's looming above me, backgrounded by the black and red motif of her childhood bedroom, or I'm looking down at her as she lolls on her bed amid blush pillows. That's her streetwear brand. Its logo is an off-kilter stick figure. With her enviable eyebrows, button nose, and heavy-lidded eyes, she looks not unlike a fresh-faced Marilyn Monroe, albeit with a two-tone dye job, the raven black pushed out by neon green roots. In photos, she smolders or glowers or sulks. Her music videos are awash in black liquids streaming from her eyes, oil spills, burn marks, tarantulas, disembodied hands clawing at her face. Phineas has worked the sickening whiz of a dentist drill and the wet sock of Eilish removing her Invisalign into her songs. There is an extreme teenness to her, which elicits the same sort of rebukes bestowed upon other young stars, Kristen Stewart most notably, who haven't taken fondly to instant fame. A screenshot of Eilish, her lip curled in what appears to be confused derision, went viral seemingly nanoseconds after she made the expression during Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph's performance at the 2020 Academy Awards, drawing instant ire for her apparent diss of our comedic lords and saviors. But the Twitter takedowns left out context. Eilish had been smiling up at the performance until she caught sight of herself on a giant screen. At the Grammys, following her sweep of every other major category, the camera caught her mouthing, "Please don't let it be me," like a shy overachiever on school awards day before they called Album of the Year. It was her. Billy is a member of the unique moment in history, says R.J. Cutler, who directs the forthcoming Apple Plus documentary Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry, which filmed from 2018 into early 2020, where perhaps every second of her life has been recorded in some form or another. Cutler, director of The War Room and executive producer of ABC's Nashville, had been immediately drawn to the project. "Those stories of teenage life are so interesting to me. It's such a fascinating time of life, when you were both child and adult, one foot in childhood, one foot in adulthood, and especially for somebody who's going through what Billy was going through and who was such a remarkable talent." Eilish was excited about the prospect of the documentary from the beginning. "I just have always loved cameras," she says, "that moment at the Oscars aside, and I loved being on camera, and I've always loved watching videos of myself since I was a little kid. I remember being 10 and being like, 'Mom, can I watch home movies?'" Her first steps at 10 months were captured on film because, as her mother, Maggie Bayard, says, the minute she knew that she was on that camera, she wanted to see it. She wanted the camera, so I just backed up and she walked to me. Eilish is sentimental about memory, and she fills boxes under her bed with mementos, receipts from a trip to Japan, keys to old diaries, a beanie that belonged to the first person she fell in love with. "I have perfumes in that box, small little vials of perfumes that smell exactly the way I smelled in that relationship," she says, "and another one that smells like somebody that was abusive to me mentally." For all her professional Sturm und Drang, in conversation, she's animated and smiley, her big blue eyes often crinkling at the corners. "In our creative life and minds," she says of herself and Phineas, "we're just at an all-time good." She was 16 when she recorded When We All Fall Asleep, and parts of it were great, and I love that album, but I was, she says, not in a great mental place. Since then, she started seeing a therapist. She's more settled. She laughs a lot. A mid-sentence hiccup when she's making fun of her own earnestness, a throaty chuckle when she's proud of and or flabbergasted by her trajectory, like when I ask where she keeps her Grammys, and she says, "Right on the shelf, right on the shelf, heh heh." But the ultimate Eilish laugh is an open mouth, grinning eyebrows raised ha-ha that falls somewhere between a chortle and a squawk. It is a laugh that might belong to a very charming cartoon chicken. The music she's working on now, she says, feels exactly how I want it to. There isn't one song or one part of one song that I wish was this or that I wish it was that. An early single, Therefore I Am, thrilled fans and critics with its Can't Touch This vibe, coupled with Descartes' reflections on being, the lyrics a decoder ring of references. Eilish describes it as a pretty solid effort type song. In the music video, filmed at the Glendale Galleria on an iPhone at 4 a.m., she acts out a universal fantasy of any budding American consumer, running through the mall's empty fluorescence, collecting junk food from various stalls. She's vegan, so while the chips from Chipotle and pretzel from Wetzel's were good to go, she special ordered glazed donuts from the Highland Park Bakery Donut Friend. Even without the documentary, aspects of the Eilish origin story have been so well chronicled as to achieve a kind of mythic status. That her parents homeschooled, or unschooled, both her and Phineas, in part because their father was inspired when he learned that the Hanson brothers had been taught at home and allowed to pursue whatever creative endeavors most struck their fancy, paving the way for Mbop. That Phineas and Eilish recorded the mesmeric, ethereal Ocean Eyes for her dance class, and when they uploaded it to SoundCloud in November 2015, it went viral overnight. That a growth plate injury soon after would end her dance aspirations, and around the same time she wouldn't make it into the exclusive chamber choir in the Los Angeles Children's Chorus, which she'd been singing with since age 8. Both of which contributed to later bouts of depression. That in summer 2016, then 25-year-old Justin Lubliner signed her to Interscope Records. Her appeal transcends generations. She's found admirers in Alicia Keys, who recorded a cover of Ocean Eyes, Julia Roberts, who has said she is everything, and Dave Grohl, who called her unbelievable. Woody Harrelson, who hosted the 2019 season premiere of Saturday Night Live, for which she was the musical guest, calls her a little bit otherworldly. But unsurprisingly, it's teen girls who make up the most vocal contingent of her fan base. Harrelson had to keep the fact that Eilish was performing at the show from his teen daughter because he knew she'd insist on coming to the show. Which, of course, he says, she couldn't come to the show because she's in school. A great deal of it has to do with how much my daughter loves the music. Also, there's something about Billy that just feels genuine, he says. She's just herself, which is very hard to be. She's direct and unaffected, her father, Patrick O'Connell, says. It's disarming and visible to anyone who sees it. But I think it's so appealing and magnetic to her fans. There is a typical Billie Eilish fan experience, he says, channeling it. Oh my gosh, she's just like me. Oh my God, we could be friends if we only knew each other. Oh my God, she's saying exactly what I would say. The teenage years are often fueled by big emotions, an enormous and self-critical solipsism, and the feeling that nobody understands, nobody sees, that every terrible, confusing, embarrassing aspect of life is happening to you and you alone. Art is the thing that saves us, that teaches us early lessons in empathy. Others can and do experience the same feelings of lust, of sadness, of shame. It's a sense of being seen, a first taste of deep love. The looks on the faces of Eilish's fans, so many of them young, so many of them girls, as they stare up at her on stage and weep, is so universal, so visceral, it's earth-shaking. That kind of devotion, Eilish says, makes you kind of crazy. We all know the feeling of seeing yourself and being like, what is going on with me? I'm acting insane. When you're excited about something, you forget boundaries, and you forget what's polite and what's kind of not polite. I've had a lot of weird situations. People will kiss me and pick me up, spin me around. For meet and greets, back when those were still happening, members of her team started briefing the kids in line about how to behave. It is definitely important to have the boundaries and also have people around you that can help in a situation like that, Eilish says. I never want to push away somebody that's showing me only love. And even if it's coming from a place of crazy love, I don't ever want to push that too far away. I think Patrick and I, in a way, get to benefit from it a little bit more than Billy does, because we can see the beautiful effect she's having on people's lives, says Baird. It's hard for her to take that in. You can easily feel like you're letting people down. Part of her connection with her fans, Eilish says, is because she understands them so well, and describes herself as a fan-type person. Her own musical obsessions are well catalogued, in particular, her early infatuation with Justin Bieber, for which her mother once considered putting her into therapy. In April 2019, they met for the first time at Coachella. Eilish stood speechless in front of him for a full 30 seconds before falling into his arms for an airport terminal-grade hug. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.